Kosinski, and it's my pleasure to be here with you this evening. I'm a volunteer in the Education Department at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. My talk this evening grew from a research presentation I gave to the Gardner volunteer community in December. I am both honored and humbled to be among the distinguished speakers in the collaborative Lenten lecture series. I would like to thank the staff and the members of the St. John St. Paul Collaborative who helped behind the scenes. And thank you all for coming tonight, especially my colleagues from the Gardner Museum over here. We are blessed with a wonderful community. The theme of our Lenten lecture series is water, and our presenters have spoken to us of water in different ways. Tonight, as we look at the painting of Christ carrying the cross, we'll see water expressed in its most human and intimate forms, tears, as in the tears of Jesus. Christ carrying the cross was Isabella Stewart Gardner's favorite painting, and it occupies a very special place at the Gardner Museum. It is attributed to the circle of Giovanni Bellini, a Venetian painter, and is dated 1505 to 1510, the early years of the Italian High Renaissance. Tonight we'll discuss the background and provenance of this painting and the stories these tell us. We'll look at why the placement of this painting at her museum was so important to Mrs. Gardner and what that reveals about faith and memory. Lastly, we'll consider how Mrs. Gardner's relationship with this painting demonstrates how the affective nature of art helps us to be more fully human. We'll see how art, as a meditative tool, opens our hearts to God. Let's begin by looking at Mrs. Gardner's story. The image on your left is a portrait of Isabella Stewart Gardner by the American artist John Singer Sargent. It was painted in Boston in 1888 and is located in the museum's Gothic room. The image on your right is a portrait of Mrs. Gardner by the Swedish artist Anders Zorn. It was painted in Venice in 1894 and is located in the museum's Short Gallery. These images depict the two distinct sides of Mrs. Gardner. Zorn captures Isabella's vivacious, sensual, and outgoing personality, while Sargent captures her strong spiritual character. Note how Sargent has framed her head with a halo to emphasize the point. So who was she really? Isabella Stewart was born in New York City in 1840 to a wealthy family. She was the oldest of four children, and her father, David Stewart, made his fortune in the Irish linen trade as well as in mining investments. At the age of 16, Isabella was sent to finishing school in France, where two events occurred that would change her life forever. On a trip to Italy with her parents, she visited the private Poli Pizzoli House Museum in Milan. Isabella was so awed by the art and the beauty she encountered there that she vowed in a letter to a friend that she too would have a house just like it one day. At school, she befriended classmate Julia Gardner of Boston. On a visit to Boston, Isabella later met and fell in love with Jack Gardner, Julia's older brother and the most eligible bachelor in Boston at that time. The Gardners were a wealthy and socially prominent Boston family. They traced their wealth back to America's first China trade, which occurred from the end of the American Revolution to the 1840s. We are now in America's second China trade. Jack and Isabella married in 1860 in New York. He was 23 and she was 20. They settled on Beacon Street in Boston's Back Bay in a townhouse built for them as a wedding present by Isabella's father. Jack and Isabella were to have a long, happy, and full life together, sharing a love of art, adventure, travel, and stimulating friendships both here and abroad. Tragedy and suffering struck early in the Gardner's marriage, though. Their only child, a son named Jackie after his dad, passed away before his second birthday. Mrs. Gardner conceived again after Jackie's death, but miscarried and was told that she could not have children. Isabella was devastated by these losses and fell into a deep, dark depression. She was bedridden with grief. To lift her spirits, her doctor prescribed travel abroad, and a better prescription could not have been written. In 1867, Jack took Isabella to Scandinavia and Northern Europe. It was the first of many trips they would take together over the next 30 years. In addition to Europe, The gardens would eventually travel to Egypt, the Holy Land, China, Japan, Cambodia, India, and the American West. They discovered Venice in 1884, and it became their favorite travel destination. They would spend months there at a time, and while in Venice, they stayed at the Palazzo Barbaro, which later became the model for the Gardner Museum. Back in Boston, Mrs. Gardner enjoyed a full life as a woman of society and a patron of the arts. Boston was a staid and provincial city back then, and Mrs. Gardner stood out. Although she had married into the uppermost crust of Boston Brahmin society, she was a New Yorker with a strong, independent spirit who loved life and engaged with the world. She had a keen and inquiring mind. Mrs. Gardner loved to read and collected first edition books before she collected art. She studied art history and read Dante with Charles Eliot Norton at Harvard. From her studies, she developed a deep knowledge of art and a love of Dante. Dante was instrumental. He sparked her interest in Italy and became her gateway to the art of the Italian Renaissance. The bulk of Mrs. Gardner's art collecting occurred in the 1890s. Her father passed away in 1891, leaving her an inheritance of $1.6 million. That would be the equivalent of about $40 million today. Jack and Isabella were rich, but this inheritance allowed Mrs. Gardner to collect art on an entirely different scale. Mrs. Gardner worked with art historian Bernard Berenson to identify and acquire works of art from private European collections. The purchase of Rembrandt's self-portrait in 1896 became the tipping point for Jack and Isabella's decision to build a permanent museum to hold their collection. Their travels abroad had convinced them that America, as a new country, had little art and culture of its own. With a museum to hold their collection, the Gardners hoped to educate the American public by bridging the gap between the old world and the new. Let's look briefly at the artist and his Venetian milieu. Giovanni Bellini was a Venetian painter of the early years of the Italian High Renaissance. Through his art and through his teaching, he had a huge impact on Venetian painting. Christ Carrying the Cross was first attributed to his circle in the year 1970. Giovanni was from an artistic family. He and his older brother Gentile were trained to paint by their father, Jacopo Bellini. Giovanni would continue and expand on his father's teaching tradition by having a large and influential teaching studio of his own. By training the next generation of painters, he would deeply influence Venetian art. Two of his illustrious pupils were Giorgione and Titian, whom we'll hear more about later. Giovanni painted on a monumental scale with large altarpieces, and on a smaller, more intimate scale with devotional images and portraits, as we see here. Giovanni achieved a spiritual likeness in his religious portraits. He used light and brilliant color to convey mood. The luminosity achieved from his use of these elements evokes a sacred presence, and his figures are radiant. His works are like icons in their simplicity and quiet austerity. Italy, at the time of the Renaissance, was not a unified nation as it is today. It was composed of independent city-states, and there were distinct differences in the artistic styles of the art produced in the city-states. While most Italian Renaissance cities looked back to classical Rome for artistic inspiration, Venice had strong roots in Byzantium. Renaissance Venice also traded with the Ottoman Turks when other Catholic European states would not. There is Eastern influence in Bellini's work, therefore. His devotional objects, such as Christ Carrying the Cross, reflect the influence of Eastern icon traditions. But Christ Carrying the Cross is a devotional object. It is not an icon. What's the difference between the two? An icon is a carefully prescribed reproduction of a holy person or an event. An icon is venerated, and it is used as a formal vehicle for prayer and meditation. It is like a rosary. A devotional object, on the other hand, is representational and allows the artist and the viewer a freer and broader range of expression. A devotional object functions like a small altar for individual prayer and worship. So who actually painted Christ Carrying the Cross? When Mrs. Gardner purchased this painting in 1898, she thought she was acquiring a Giorgione, who trained under Bellini. If you're familiar with Giorgione's work, it's easy to understand why both she and Bernard Berenson believed this. Giorgione's work has a softness and a sense of mystery about it that is present in Christ Carrying the Cross. In 1970, art historian Pietro Zampetti, in his book on Giorgione, was the first to designate the artist of the Gardner painting as the Circle of Bellini. In 1974, the Gardner updated their catalog and formally cited Circle of Bellini as the painter of Christ carrying the cross. More recently, in 2002, Alan Chong, a former Gardner Museum curator, suggested that Vincenzo Catena might be the painter. Catena was a colleague of Bellini. As we can see, authorship can be an ongoing process. The Toledo Museum of Art in Toledo, Ohio, also has a Christ carrying the cross in their permanent collection. It was purchased in 1940 as an original Bellini, and after the Gardner's 1974 redesignation, our painting was considered a copy of theirs. In 1986, however, while the Toledo painting was in conservation, it was determined that although Bellini had worked on that painting, it could not be attributed to him alone. Hence, Toledo's designation became follower of Bellini. The Toledo Museum of Art further states that Bellini's large studio produced 55 known versions of the devotional image of Christ carrying the cross. There's even one at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, with the artist designation as after Giovanni Bellini. It's possible that Bellini contributed to many of the devotional images produced in his workshop, if not all. So how did Mrs. Gardner acquire this painting? Let's look at provenance. Provenance is defined as the chronology of the ownership, custody, or location of a work of art or historical object. Mrs. Gardner's interest in this painting began in September of 1896. Working with the art historian Bernard Berenson, it took her almost 2 years to acquire it. Mrs. Gardner really wanted a Giorgione. She preferred to acquire Giorgione's The Tempest, but that was now not possible. Christ Carrying the Cross was called the Loschi Giorgione after its home, the Palazzo Loschi in Vicenza. Vicenza is a city in northern Italy situated between Venice and Milan. The Boston Museum of Fine Arts was initially interested in this painting, but later withdrew, saying that it was a fake. We now know that their assessment was correct and that this painting was not by Giorgione. The negotiations with the Soleri family were protracted. The father had willed the painting to the city of Vicenza, and his will had to be revoked in order to sell the painting. The citizens of Vicenza were furious and up in arms. They did not want to sell the painting. They did not want the painting to leave their city. And the Soleri family feared repercussions if they sold it to Mrs. Gardner. The painting was finally sold on the condition that a copy was made for the Soleri family. In January of 1898, Berenson brought the painting from Italy to England, wrapped in a blanket, as he described in a letter to Mrs. Gardner. Berenson was known for his rather creative ways of getting art out of the country. The painting traveled first to Paris, where Robert Gallet executed the required copy for the Soleri family, and then on to Boston, where Mrs. Gardner received the painting during the month of December of 1898. Jack Gardner died unexpectedly on December 10th of 1898 at the age of 61. This timing strongly suggests that Mrs. Gardner would forever associate Christ carrying the cross with the death of her beloved husband. They had been married for 38 years. What happened to Isabella after Jack's death? Let's look at Mrs. Gardner's palace for the answer. Upon Jack's death in 1898, Mrs. Gardner became a widow at the age of 58. From her experience with depression 30 years earlier after the loss of her infant son and miscarriage, Mrs. Gardner understood the importance of keeping busy and active. She immediately threw herself into realizing their plans for building a museum. Within 6 months, she had purchased land in the Fenway section of Boston and hired the architect Willard Sears. At the time, Frederick Law Olmsted was designing the Emerald Necklace in the city of Boston, and Mrs. Gardner's palace would soon become the jewel on the Emerald Necklace. This is a slide of the courtyard at the Gardner Museum. The palace building was completed in 1901 under Mrs. Gardner's strict supervision and eye for detail, and was called Fenway Court. Her love of Venice and of Italian culture inspired the design of her museum. Structurally, it was built according to Italian Renaissance building principles, and aesthetically, it was modeled after a Venetian palazzo. Mrs. Gardner poured her heart and her soul into creating her palace. It is a work of great beauty and love. This is an image of the courtyard, which is the living, breathing heart of the museum. This is where we Bostonians go during the bleakness of winter to hope that spring will return soon. Mrs. Gardner moved into Fenway Court in 1901 and spent 18 months installing her collection before she opened her home to the public as a museum in 1903. Mrs. Garden would live at Fenway Court in an apartment on the fourth story for 23 years until her death at the age of 84 in 1924. This is an image of the Titian Room, which we will talk more about soon. Mrs. Garden built Fenway Court to share her love of art and beauty with the American public. Every painting and art object in her collection were placed in ways that were purposeful and meaningful to her. The rooms are theme-based, and the paintings are placed in relation to the works and objects around them. They tell us stories. There were no labels by the paintings, and that's because Mrs. Gardner wanted her guests to experience her art directly and not get caught up in written details. According to her will, nothing in the museum may be moved or rotated. This is one of the reasons that the lighting in the museum is kept so low. It is a conservation measure to keep in accordance with the terms of Mrs. Gardner's will. Mrs. Garden's museum has a spiritual quality, and if you've been there, you know what I'm speaking of. The light in the galleries is mutable and contributes to the beautiful hominess of the museum. The natural light from the Fenway and the courtyard has a living, breathing quality that imbues the museum with warmth. The paintings and the rooms take on different moods in the transient light over the course of the day, and this is wondrous to behold. I sometimes do day-long shifts at the Gardner, and I love to watch the light change over the course of the day. It's just really wonderful. This is the chapel at the Gardner Museum. It's located on the third floor at the end of the long gallery. Mrs. Gardner was a deeply religious woman, and she experienced God through art and beauty. She was a devout Anglo-Catholic and a member of the Church of the Advent on Beacon Hill. Today we would call her High Church Episcopalian. The term Anglo-Catholic refers to beliefs and practices within Anglicanism that emphasizes its Catholic heritage and identity. Although Anglo-Catholics do not believe in transubstantiation as Roman Catholics do, they do believe in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. From her love of Venice, Dante, and Italian Renaissance art, Mrs. Gardner had a deep affinity for the Roman Catholic faith and had Catholic friends. Fenway Court includes a consecrated Episcopal chapel, which you see in this image. An Episcopal Mass is said here every year on Mrs. Gardner's birthday, which is coming up on April 14th. In addition to the Memorial Mass, the museum hangs trailing nasturtiums from the windows over the courtyard during that week, heralding the arrival of spring in Boston. Nasturtiums were Mrs. Gardner's favorite flower. This is the Titian Room again. It's named for the painter of the Rape of Europa, which you see in the background. The placement of Christ carrying the cross in the foreground and the Rape of Europa in the background reflects the spiritual and sensual sides of Mrs. Gardner that we saw in the Sargent and Zorn portraits of her earlier in this presentation. We'll talk more about this. Mrs. Gardner placed Christ carrying the cross on a table in the Titian Room by a north window to ensure that it received good light. A chair was placed at the table for meditation. The silver cup on the table to the right of the painting is from Norway. It was a gift from her husband Jack during their first trip abroad together in 1867, after the death of their son Jackie. In memory of her husband, her son, and the trip that brought her back to life, Mrs. Gardner's will specifies that fresh flowers be placed in this cup every day. The painting and its placement show a soft and vulnerable side to Mrs. Gardner that we don't often think of when we think of Mrs. Gardner. Morris Carter, the museum's first director, said that it was her favorite painting. Let's look more closely at Christ carrying the cross as a devotional image. As a devotional image, this painting represents the passion of Jesus the Christ in a portrait format. As we know, Christ comes from the Greek word Christos, which means anointed one or chosen one, is the Greek equivalent of the Hebrew word for Messiah. In their book, Artist Therapy, authors Elaine de Botton and John Armstrong remark, Christian art made a point of presenting its most central figure in situations of misery and despair. Their aim was to remind us that pain and sadness are not the result of getting life wrong in some way, but the ordinary accompaniments of trying to do the right thing. From the Gospels, we know that Jesus has been cruelly mocked, scourged, and sentenced to death by Roman authority. He carries his cross to Calvary, where he will be crucified. We do not see any of that here, only a mystical sadness. Framed as he is by compositional elements, this Jesus has a transcendent quality. A dark crown of spiky hawthorn branches surrounds his head. In his book, The Secret Language of Flowers, French artist Jean-Michel Otoniel writes that the hawthorn is a tree of mystical protection, present in most sanctuaries, forming a barrier physically with its thorns, as well as symbolically, to demarcate the sacred precinct. The massive cross slices through the painting in two bold intersecting diagonal lines, anchoring Jesus securely in the foreground and blocking out completely the noise of the Via Dolorosa. The section of the upper cross is framed in such a way that its weight on the shoulders of Jesus is emphasized. Yet he does not struggle under it. His shoulders are strong. Jesus appears before us as the quiet eye in the center of the storm. One is drawn inexorably to a sad yet calm visage that speaks of grace and inner strength, what Otoniel might call the sacred precinct. We know that Jesus is suffering profoundly, but he gives so little of that away, but for his sad dark eyes and the two barely perceptible tears that flow from them. Considering our Lenten theme of water, what might these two spare tears suggest to us? The Gospels tell us that Jesus wept copious tears in the Garden of Gethsemane as he prayed to his Father to be spared the suffering and death that awaited him on Good Friday. The two tears in Christ carrying the cross tell us that Jesus has accepted his destiny. When we pray to God, we know that we can share our tears and our fears openly and freely. God has strong shoulders. And with God's help, we know that we can be brave when we confront what the world has in store for us. The bold restraint in the use of color, texture, and form draws attention to the face of Jesus. As a portrait, the face of Jesus is the most detailed part of the painting, and it's where the action occurs. We see the warm tones in the texture of his curling hair and beard, and we observe his haunting, mystical expression that looks down into the side. In every aspect, this is a painting of great dignity and quiet strength. Beholding it, we experience an iconic sense of peace, the peace of Christ. What does the placement of Christ carrying the cross tell us with respect to its 16th century Venetian neighbors in the Titian room? Titian's painting, The Rape of Europa, hangs on the northeast wall, and Paris Bordoni's painting, The Child Jesus Disputing in the Temple, hangs almost directly opposite on the northwest wall. The Titian depicts a rich and sensually painted abduction scene from the pagan world of classical mythology. The Bordoni represents a carefully ordered scene from the Gospels. Titian trained under Bellini, and Bordoni trained under Titian, so we have a nice representation of Bellini's teaching legacy in this room. Let's look at these two paintings more closely. The Child Jesus Disputing in the Temple is by the Venetian painter Paris Bordoni, who, as we can see, emulated Titian's beautiful use of color. The composition here has been described as making the Christ child the calm center in a composition of muscular figures and restless poses. An illuminated Jesus sits on the throne on the center right, doing the work of his Father, as the very frantic Mary and Joseph enter the temple on the left. Jesus is causing really quite a ruckus here, and is upsetting the natural establishment. He's making them think. We see the pained and thoughtful expressions of the men in the temple. We see scrolls unfurled on the floor, and more scrolls being brought in. Mrs. Gardner was well known for upsetting the establishment in her lifetime, too, so I think she might have quite enjoyed this aspect of Jesus. Once again, we see Jesus as the ever-peaceful calm in the center of the storm. He is who he is in life, and it presages things to come. The Rape of Europa by Titian was Mrs. Gardner's most prized acquisition. This painting depicts the story of the beautiful Princess Europa, who is seduced and abducted by Zeus, the king of the gods, in the disguise of a bull. Looking at the painting, we see Europa's disheveled confusion. We see Cupid's firing arrows at her to ensure that she will return Zeus's affections. We see the bull's face with a calm, mission-accomplished expression. On the shoreline on your left, we see Europa's family crying after her. The painting captures the moments of loss and abduction in a grand and dramatic manner. Our eyes follow the composition in a circular motion, from lower left, up and around, then back to Europa's lost family on the shore. The use of light and color is luminous, and the effect is breathtaking. Fun fact, this painting was commissioned by King Philip II of Spain during the height of the Spanish Inquisition. It had to be kept in his private quarters away from the prying eyes of the inquisitors. Let's have a bit of fun and look at the objects that Mrs. Gardner placed around this painting. It's hard to see here, but on the table, on the left side of the table, is a bronze cupid that emulates the shape of the cupids in the painting above. The angel candlesticks at either end of the table are giving face palms, as if to say, "Oi, my daughter's run off with a bull." Lastly, the gold rectangular shape directly under the painting is a framed panel from one of Mrs. Gardner's ball gowns from the Parisian House of Worth. Mrs. Gardner had all her clothes made in Paris. The tassels in the fabric emulate the fringe at the end of the bull's tail. This placement suggests to me that Mrs. Gardner approved of Europa being swept off her feet by the King of the Gods. It tells us she was a woman with a strong romantic streak and wanted to step right into this painting. Biographer Louise Hull Sharp described Isabella Stewart Gardner both as a devout Anglo-Catholic and as a truly sensual woman who fully embraced the pleasures of life. That both Christ carrying the cross and the Rape of Europa are the images that face and greet us as we enter the Titian room suggest that Mrs. Gardner embraced equally and in full measure the sacred and the profane. The placement of Christ carrying the cross and the Rape of Europa recognize that a full life contains both joy and suffering, light and dark, sacred and profane. Might this placement also suggest the tying together of Isabella's own past and present? The rape of Europa evoking fond memories of a younger Isabella being swept off her feet in her beautiful Worth gown by Jack, and Christ carrying the cross evoking the older widowed Isabella mourning the loss of her beloved husband? Finally, does the fact that both the Rape of Europa and Christ carrying the cross face the child Jesus disputing in the temple suggest that Mrs. Gardner, holding all these things in her heart, also looked to the teachings of her Anglo-Catholic faith for reconciliation between past and present in her new life at Fenway Court without Jack? In Artist Therapy, Elaine de Botton and John Armstrong also write about art as a tool for completing us and for making us more human, for helping us to deal with issues in life. To quote from their book, "Art is a therapeutic medium that can help guide, exhort, and console its viewers, enabling them to become better versions of themselves." In a section on art and sorrow, they write, "Art can teach us how to suffer more successfully." As a devotional image, Christ carrying the cross has this power. This painting has a deeply personal meaning for me and speaks to the evocative power of art to affect and restore. The comments that follow are personal ones that I do not share with museum visitors. In my Gardner presentation, and now with you, I share these comments to show that not only how this painting affected me, but also how it might move others, particularly museum visitors from the nearby Longwood Medical Area who may be experiencing suffering and loss in their lives. I trained as a Gardner Museum volunteer in 2015. One of our training assignments was to complete a looking log of a painting. A looking log is an observational exercise to help develop visual thinking skills and to express in writing what we see in a painting. Christ carrying the cross captured my attention, and I began working on my looking log, coincidentally at the time of the first anniversary of my brother's death. My brother Ron waged a valiant battle against cancer, bearing his pain stoically and facing his death bravely. Looking at Christ carrying the cross evoked memories of my brother. I saw that there was really no difference between a terminally ill cancer patient confronting death and with Jesus carrying the cross to his. My brother's last words to me as we embraced for our final goodbye were, "Take strength for my strength." Christ carrying the cross conveys those words to us here and now, in silence, every day at the Gardner Museum. This is a painting for those who may be broken in heart, but not in spirit. Beholding this painting, I believe that Mrs. Gardner found strength and hope in it again and again, just as I found consolation. It helped us both to be brave. Now, this is the part in my talk where I have to be brave and watch my tears. My brother passed away a week before Ash Wednesday in 2014. Lent and Easter that year held deeper meaning for me than ever before. Ron's suffering and death and his bravery in the face of that brought me to the very heart of Jesus. It's a depth of feeling and understanding that has changed me and is Ron's gift to me. I know that Jesus is with us always, but I know now that that is especially true when we suffer, die, or lose a loved one, as we all shall in our lifetimes. But there is comfort and joy at the end, and our celebration of Easter reminds us of this every single year. This is the beautiful gift of our Catholic Christian faith. When I behold Christ carrying the cross now, my faith is made new again. My last words to you are these. Open yourself to art, and you will open yourself to God. Don't worry about a lack of formal knowledge of art history or names and dates and styles. Remember, Mrs. Gardner did not use labels in her museum on purpose. She wanted her guests to experience art and beauty directly. As Sister Wendy Beckett has demonstrated, a work of art does not have to be religious to speak to us, although that can be helpful. Find a work of art and let it become your friend. When you look at a work of art, take the time to truly behold it. Let it spark your imagination, delight your senses, and most importantly, touch your heart. Let art make a space for beauty in your soul. Thank you.